Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Cody Liska.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our theme for the show is Under the Influence. We'll hear stories of mad love, losing control, and drinking the Kool-Aid.
Our first storyteller this hour is a born and raised Alaskan who works as an attorney in Anchorage. Here's Sarah Jane Shine on the stage at the Beartooth Theater Pub.
When I was in my late 20s, I found myself living in the suburbs of Sacramento and dating a guy whose primary passion in life was drinking protein shakes. And so I had to ask myself, like, is this it? Is this my destiny? And I decided that no, it wasn't, and I was going to move back home to Alaska. Yes. And I envisioned a life of adventure alongside a handsome companion who probably wore a lot of Patagonia, had a rugged beard, and looked exactly like Jake Gyllenhaal. But once I moved home, I quickly learned that this fantasy I had didn't match my reality. It was getting cold and dark, I didn't really have any friends, and I was studying for the Alaska bar. So most of my weekends were spent alone in bed watching Netflix and eating Taco Bell, and frequently crying. So if this wasn't tragic enough, I temporarily moved back to my childhood home in Valdez and spent Valentine's Day doing Zumba with my mom at the Valdez Teen Center. So at this point, I'm really thinking, oh, I've made a mistake. But things really started to quickly turn around because, as you know, at this time of year when the light starts coming back, you have a little more optimism. I actually had friends who spent time with me on the weekends. And best of all, I started making progress on my workplace crush. And so I had met Jim right when I started working, and I was interested right away, but I was going through a breakup with the protein powder loving guy. We were coworkers. So we were understandably cautious. So nothing was really happening beyond me torturing everyone in my life by forcing them to interpret the emails between us. And whether they were flirtatious or friendly. But then one thrilling Friday night, Jim asked me to meet him at Spinard Roadhouse. And the Roadhouse led to Darwin's. So hopefully you know that this is a good night. Not that good of a night, not after dark night, but it was great, and it kicked off what I will say is the best first week of dating that has ever existed in ever. And this was the winter of 2012, so I'm hoping more people are familiar with the winter of 2012 than the snow goose. If you remember, we actually had snow. It was beautiful. And so most of our first dates that week were spent cross-country skiing after work, and I was just like, high on life, because my dream was coming true. And I'm going to break Arctic Entries protocol and actually read notes. And this is where my fanny pack comes in very handy. Because I wanted to capture verbatim some of my exchanges from this time. So here is an email to my friend Becky, who's in the audience. And I said, also, wow, office romance. At this point, the likelihood of me having an I saw Jim naked story this weekend is seeming probable. And I'm really sorry, Dad, I've never seen anyone naked and no one has seen me naked. Also, I hope there aren't that many coworkers in the audience. Speaking of my dad, I also emailed him and said, I like a boy. This is embarrassing that I'm in my late 20s and emailing my dad and saying this. We went skiing and then he made me dinner. And my dad's response, I'm impressed by his running times. Go ahead and ask him if he wants to have children. They will be fast, so I'll plan to tell another story at the daddy issues theme that comes up, because obviously there's a reason why I was putting so much pressure on myself. But after this amazing, for all the lawyers out there who appreciate billable hours, this was a text from Jim, and he said, you're going to have an expensive bill this month for the amount of time I've spent thinking about you during work hours. Yes. Oh, so I am just, like I said, intoxicated. I am drinking the Alaska Spring Kool-Aid. And at the end of this magical first week of dating, I was headed to the Usyk ski race in Talkeetna. And so I hope all of you have been to Talkeetna. But every time I go to Talkeetna, it involves wearing a costume much like this and drinking whiskey in the streets by 11 a.m. So on this race day, it was a bluebird day. Denali was out. I was there with my friends because I had friends now. I was wearing this very fanny pack filled with miniature flavored vodkas because there's nothing better to hydrate for a race than marshmallow vodka. And so throughout this day, we have this great race day, and Jim and I are texting, and at the end of the night, we end at the Fairview, and I'm just so happy, and I text Jim, "I love you." Yeah, ooh. So yeah, we've been hanging out for 5 days. We're coworkers who are attorneys, and I have texted him, "I love you." And I haven't mentioned this, but Jim is a little more reserved than I am. I mean, he's not wearing tutus, doing races, taking shots of vodka. So there's crickets from Jim after I text him this, and I'm like, even in the state I'm in, I'm like, I gotta fix this. I gotta neutralize this situation. I gotta bring it back to the middle. So of course I text him, "I hate you." Because I'm like, I fixed that problem. I went too far. So now we're just at a medium, "I like you a lot." Jim still's not responding, and so he's either ignoring me or asleep, and I think it's the horrified, "Oh my God." And so my last move of the night was to send him a selfie of myself in this outfit in the bathroom at the Fairview. So when I woke up the next morning, I realized, like, wow, I had it all for 5 days. I had the Alaska dream, and I threw it away with an "I love you, I hate you" selfie text exchange. But we had a date scheduled the next night for the Long Branch, and, you know, crazy texts be damned, I was going to that date. So, you know, even though the pit in my stomach is growing as I drive back to Anchorage, I drive straight to his house wearing this outfit and show up at his front door and proceed to have the most awkward date at the Long Branch, where most of our conversation was Jim trying to awkwardly but kindly explain that he actually couldn't go ice skating with me the next day. So I was pretty sad, and my last text was, I sent a friend the text, "My office romance may have imploded. Don't take shots out of a fanny pack." Exclamation, exclamation, exclamation. So I was pretty sad, and I really had nothing to lose at this point, so my last move was to email him and say, "Sorry about the cardboard cutout of myself, life-size cutout of myself that I left in your office." You must be really proud of me, Dad. You know, as I'm sure you can imagine, it was a very awkward Monday at work. He's thinking, here's this girl I have to deal with all the time who dresses like this and told me I love you after 5 days, and I'm sure you all know how this story ends, which is that Jim and I just celebrated our 4-year wedding anniversary. And when people ask, you know, like, what turned his, because he was certainly pulling the plug, and it was over. What changed his mind? And there really is no good explanation than he was drinking the Kool-Aid too, you know? Because we all get high on life in Alaska in March. But, you know, these days I skip the flavored vodka.
That was Sarah Jane Shine, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. During this hour, we are once again hearing Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives.
This hour is unique in that the stories come from an Arctic Entry special event at the Beartooth. For these shows, we sometimes make an exception to our one story rule and invite former storytellers back on stage.
You may remember him from the infamous Speedogate scandal, but that's another story. Here's Jeff Landfield.
In summer 2009, I met a Ukrainian girl at a Russian Mirror Lake party. and she was great. And we very quickly, in a few weeks, fell in love, and we had a great time. But 2 months later, she had to go back to Ukraine because her visa was expiring. And I was in my last semester at UAA, so we decided we would see each other again after I finished university. So we kept in touch. Fast forward 6 months, finished university, saved some money up, and I bought a ticket, and I flew to Ukraine. Zhenya lives in Western Ukraine, which, if you've been over there, you know, Kiev's like Kiev, but then Western Ukraine, it's a whole different kind of Ukraine. So it's way different than the Russian part of Ukraine. So I fly to Kiev, I'm very excited. I've been to Russia many years before. I spoke Russian fairly well, but not great. And I get there and I get on this very like old Russian style train to Chernivtsi, which is like a 14-hour train ride. Get there, get off the train, she's waiting for me. I see her, I'm very excited, and she, you know, it's awesome. I'm so happy to be there. We go out, she was living with her mom at the time, didn't want to stay with her mom and her, it would have been probably weird. Definitely would have been weird. So I met this guy on the internet, Paul, who was from England, who had a hostel in Chernivtsi, and this guy didn't belong there, even much less than me. And he claimed he spun a globe, and he was 50, and he was tired of his life, and he landed on Ukraine, and he opened a hostel, and sold his possessions, and this was I can't even describe him. So I tell Zhenya, I met Paul on the internet, I'm going to stay with him in his hostel. So we go to his hostel. Nobody is in there. It's his old Ukrainian Russian building. It's like decrepit. And she, you know, we have a drink with him and her and Paul, and he's very nice. And she leaves. And before she leaves, she goes, "Jeff, don't forget, this is not America. Don't go out to discotheque. Don't go nowhere. Relax. Not America. People very different than Ukraine." I'm like, "No problem. Great." She leaves. Paul and I have some, you know, vodka, of course, and Paul goes, "Hey, mate, you want to go to discotheque?" I go, "Yes, I want to go to the discotheque." So we go into this thing, right? And if you've been to like Eastern Europe or Ukraine or Russia or anywhere, you walk in, it's like 80% women, attractive, hot, dancing. The few men that are there in the corner smoking and dressed kind of like me right now. And, you know, it's just, there's vodka and there's food and it's great. So sit down, start drinking. I heeded her advice, but then I got drunk, and I started talking to Andre and Yuri. And, you know, they were pretty nice. You know, it was great. We were having a good time getting drunk. And thing closed at 4 a.m. We're leaving, and Andre and Yuri encouraged me to go with them to another party. And outside is this large kind of box Mercedes van, no windows. And I tell Paul, "I'm going with Andre and Yuri." And he goes, "Mate, you're not going there. That's a bad idea." And I go, "No, we're going." So he doesn't want to go, but I get in. We're driving. Bad decision. They're drunk. They asked me to get on the microphone and start telling people to move out the way in English, which I gladly did. We go to get gas. We're out of the city. They asked me to pay for the gas, which I thought was weird because that's not really a cultural type, you know, make me pay. So I paid, then I was like, "I'm getting out of here." But before I could do that, they told me to get back in the van. And I said, "Well, I don't want to do that." But let's say I had no choice. I get back in the van thinking, what's going to happen? And if you speak Russian or if you understand, the guy said, "Dai деньги, блядь. Dai паспорт," which means, "Give me the money, give me your passport." And I said, well, I didn't say this. My passport was at the Paul's hostel. And the money I had with me, I already spent on the gas. And I explained to them I didn't have much money. So we're driving, and the guy reaches in the glove box, and he pulls out an old World War II style Walther pistol, and he points it at me. And he said, in Russian, "If you don't have money, you're worthless to us." So I explained to them I have a card, and I was actually really scared. I was very like, this is crazy, if guns pointed at me. So I explained to them I have a card. I said, "Well, go to the ATM, you'll get your money, because the most they're going to get is $500, and that's it," thinking that would might maybe work. It did work. And the one guy, I got to say, the one guy, Andre, was really nice, and Yuri was not very nice. It was classic good cop, bad cop. So we go to the first ATM, and I explained to them, "You know, I'm going to put the card in, put the pin in, you guys take the money, and that's it." And they agreed to that, which I thought was, you know, they're my age, not professionals here, because I want to say, "Give me the fucking pin, we're done with you." So we tried to get $1,000 out, didn't work. I said, "Let's try another ATM," try a different ATM. By our third ATM, they looked at the balance, and there was like $3,000 in there. And he goes, "Where's the fucking money?" And I said, "I just graduated university. I don't have much money." And they were very angry at this point. So at the fourth ATM, I decided I would try to get out of the situation. So Andre's up, or Yuri's up with me on the stairs. in the ATM. The other guy's in the car. I push him down the stairs, and I start running. I start in these old cobble streets. I'm running down. I'm looking for somebody to help me. It's snowing. It's cold. I'm drunk. I see a guy in a van or an old truck. I try to stop him to help me, and he was not interested in helping me at all, believe me. I mean, imagine me coming up. Give me help me. I'm being kidnapped by Ukrainians. And by this point, they had come across, they had found me, and they had grabbed me, thrown me on the ground, started roughing me up. I was fighting with them. I was out of breath. It was pretty wild. They threw me back in the van, drive me down a little bit of ways down the road, and they throw me out of the van. And they said, get out of here. At this point, they realized the jig was up. But I actually asked one of them, because they took all the money I had, I said, can I have like 20 hryvnia, which is like $5 back, so I can get like a cab back into town? And I swear to God, the nice guy asked the mean guy, and he's like, no way. So then I was like, well, could you guys maybe give me a lift back in town? Because I had no idea where I was. Imagine you're in Anchorage and you're out at Bird Creek. So he asked the guy in the most basic Russian, which is like, could we take the individual to the city? And he agreed. I get back in the van with Yuri and Andre. We're driving. They have a little Russian icon religious thing hanging in the mirror. And I said, I'm not greatly very religious, but I don't think, God would really appreciate your behavior. Yuri tells him, shut him the fuck up. I don't want to hear him talk anymore. We get in the city. It's about a 15-minute ride. It was pretty quiet at that point. They drop me off in this location. And I said, well, I don't know where we are. I know where the church is. Can we go to the church? Because that's where by Paul's hostel. And they actually agreed to that. And they dropped me off. And then the mean one says to me after I get out, he goes, I don't want to see you in this town anymore. Get out of here. You're not welcome in Ukraine. And I said, baby, I just got here. Next morning, I go to Jenya's house. She opens the door. She looks at me. I told you not to go to discotheque.
That was Jeff Landfield. On this hour of Arctic Entries Radio, we're hearing stories of mad love, losing control, and drinking the Kool-Aid.
Next up, Anchorage resident Jake Maloof grew up in Utah and knows a bit about influence.
So I remember looking up at my sweaty fingers as they pushed a lawnmower on a hot summer day in Utah. I didn't want to mow lawns forever, so I tried to think of the most prestigious thing I could possibly do with my life. And then in my 6-year-old mind, I knew I was to become the prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The Mormon Church, as it's called, professes a belief in Jesus, the Bible, the Book of Mormon, many revelations, has rules, what to eat, what to drink, how many body piercings are appropriate, what kind of underwear to use. It has a checkered past, but I trained myself to look past issues of institutional sexism, racism, and coercion. I committed myself to the kingdom and even promised to give my life, if necessary, to help establish Zion. So I checked all the boxes. I earned my Eagle Scout. I attended every meeting. I internalized hundreds of scriptures, and I served a 2-year proselyting mission to Italy. Soon after, Amy and I got married in a Mormon temple. And then, for the first time in our lives, we had sex. We had children, we raised children. Amy gave up many of her dreams, because she is a woman, to support mine. We never drank a drop of tea or coffee or alcohol. And we donated thousands of hours and thousands of dollars to what we sincerely believed was God's one true church upon the face of the earth. So even with our kids doing well, my career on track, I knew something was terribly off. The whitewashed history that we were taught in Sunday school didn't mesh with other sources. And over time, my personal dreams had been replaced with the goals of the church. I had lost control. I had gulped down that Kool-Aid. So I began what was for me an unprecedented investigation into the history and doctrines of the church, and not just the Mormon church. I dedicated thousands of hours to examining all of my beliefs and nearly every aspect of my life. I was convinced that this would resolve my lingering doubts. But what I discovered shook me to the core. The evidence is beyond dispute. The Mormon Church is not what it claims to be. So Amy and I cautiously brought these topics up with each other and were tremendously relieved to discover we had come to the same conclusions. So I brought my concerns up with other church leaders. This didn't go well. What used to be a place of peace and purpose soon became a place of tension and hostility. And we learned that the most important doctrine of the Mormon Church, despite its shiny veneer, is to simply obey the man who presides over you, even if it goes against your conscience. In November 2015, a new church policy was leaked to the media, later claimed as a revelation. The new policy states that children of LGBT parents are not allowed to be baptized until they are 18 and only after disavowing the lifestyle of their parents. Shockwaves rippled through the church, and we could not remain silent in the wake of so much pain and confusion. So we posted a few of our concerns onto Facebook. Within a few short months, we were directed to stop posting, voluntarily resign our membership, or face formal disciplinary action. So, recognizing an opportunity, we chose to face the Inquisition. I remember the atmosphere as we were ushered into a locked church building, each door guarded by somber men, and we met with 17 church authorities. On October 11th, 2016, we were both excommunicated from the church of our childhood. A lifetime of dedicated service, it seemed, was erased in a matter of hours. I would needless to say, many relationships were damaged by this barbaric and unnecessary act. For a moment, we thought perhaps we should try to stay in the church for our children. And then we thought, no, we need to get out of the church for our children. Of course, the choice was theirs, and we said we'd support whatever they wanted, and they were like, we're out. The details of this story were recorded on a podcast, and the loving response we received from thousands of people across the globe was truly overwhelming. We were humbled as we learned how many members of the church silently no longer believe it is true and feel so isolated when they discover their core system of belief is fundamentally flawed. Divorce, depression, suicide. Daughters are not speaking with their mothers. Fathers don't speak with their son, and neighbors don't talk with each other for fear of losing their friendships or even their livelihood. So I am talking about it. Our family made it out of the glass cage, and it feels like we won the lottery. Amy and I equalized our marriage. We discovered much healthier ways to relate with each other and our children as we spat out that damn Kool-Aid. Our conversations are often now filled with phrases like cognitive dissonance or confirmation bias or, you know, neuroplasticity or groupthink. And we have much more laughter. Personally, I have become blissfully agnostic, and I have definitely given up any plans to become a prophet. Without exception, every aspect of my life is better, including the freedom to pound a cold and hoppy IPA. Thank you.
That was Jake Maloof, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Our theme is Under the Influence, Stories of Mad Love, Losing Control, and Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Our next storyteller is the King of Good Times. But as we find out, a good time can sometimes lead to a difficult time. Here's Zach on stage at the Beartooth Theater Pub.
So I grew up in Talkeetna, and that kind of made me a de facto outdoor kid, camping, fishing, etc. And that led my parents to instill in me three really important lessons that I keep with me to this day. First, whenever you're going out into the wilderness or doing anything really, pack a lot of layers. You never know when you're going to need to take things off or put things on in order to maintain a comfortable body temperature. Second, always make sure you bring something to start a fire because you never know when it's going to go wrong and you're going to need to get warm in a hurry. And third, even if the fish aren't biting, always try and have a good time. Now, as I grew older, I interpreted the third rule a little bit differently, and that meant bring as much alcohol as you possibly could on any adventure that you went on. So it was armed with these three tools that two of my best friends in life and I, Andy and Ivan, departed on the Setuck River outside Yakutat to go steelhead fishing. It's cold on the Setuck at the end of April, so I was ready with my layers. I had on my boxer briefs, I had on some light long underwear, I had some heavy long underwear, had some thick fleece pants on the top, had my base layer, had my mid layer, had my performance jacket, and over this I tried to fit my bulbous ass into my waders. And if you can imagine for a second what it's like to put a condom on a watermelon, that's me getting into my waders. In my pockets, I had plenty of lighters and waterproof matches, no problem there. And we had about 10 to 12 bottles of whiskey for a 2.5-day trip for three men. So we checked all the boxes. Now, I caught my first steelhead of this trip on my first evening, and I was overjoyed, and the bottles popped. And we kept drinking whiskey essentially nonstop for the rest of the trip. It started early in the morning and went late into the night. On the second day, roughly 6 p.m., Andy was passed out in the bottom of the drift boat. Ivan, he's pretty capable, so he was all right, but I couldn't even tie a fly on anymore, so we decided it was probably time to call it quits. So we found a place, pulled our boat over, drank whiskey, and passed out in our tent. Now, the next morning, we woke up super early again, because that's when the fish are biting, and proceeded to sausage myself back into my waders and go out, sip from a flask, and see if anything will bite. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the shampoo effect, which is essentially like if you apply a little bit of shampoo in your hair and you wash it, and then you take a shower or keep taking a shower and forget, and put more shampoo in there, and it goes poof. Anyway, alcohol does the exact same thing. You've been drinking straight for like 24 hours, and you have a little nip in the morning, you're right back in her. So that was essentially the predicament I found myself in out in the middle of the Setuck River. And that's when it hit me. The most pure form of human urgency. So I knew that approximately 100 feet up the bank, that's where our camp was, there was an immaculately prepared kit that Ivan had made. It had baby wipes, had double-ply toilet paper, hand sanitizer, lighter to destroy the evidence, all that stuff. So I knew if I could just get there, I was going to be all right, because it was just a short walk up a little bluff in order to get to a safe space. I took a couple steps, and it was over. It just happened. Anyway, at this point, I'm essentially duck walking to try and minimize the damage as best I can. I secure the kit and I walk up into the forest. So eventually I found the perfect spot. There was a nice big tree and something to hold on to because for a man of my build, squatting isn't really a good look. So I sort of braced myself and removed my coat, peeled down my waders. And I will spare you the graphic details, but I used a lot of the product in that kit to clean myself up. But what you have to realize about my predicament now is I'm essentially wall sitting against this tree with all of my layers down by my feet, still blocked by my wading boots, and these underwear still there. So I realize I need to get these things off of me and as quickly as possible. So I start to tear at this leg and I rip it. And I try and tear the elastic, and that's a no-go. I do the other leg, and I'm like, I'll figure this out. Rule number two, always pack a lighter. So I start to burn the left side, trying to avoid the little bits of rubber that are dripping down. I finally get it done, and I move on to the other side. And then, like a gigantic baby, victoriously ripping his diaper from his body, I cast them aside. After I'm completely clean-ish, I reapply my layers, and then I look down at what I have just done. Now, the whole leave your no trace behind thing in the wilderness was certainly going to be a problem if I left things as they were. So I harnessed all of the tools that my parents had taught me, and I built a fire. And I started burning my clothes and all of the rags and things that I had accumulated throughout this process. And there's a huge plume of smoke going up into the air at this point. I'm like, man, someone's going to notice and wonder what the hell I'm doing out here. But after probably 15 minutes, everything had been destroyed, and I was able to cover things back up with moss and twigs, and it looked pretty good, all things considered. I gathered what was left of my dignity, and I walked back down to the river. I grabbed a bottle of whiskey, sat on the shore, thought, man, I'm one layer down, but I'm still feeling pretty good. I was able to use fire to literally get out of the situation. And I got this whiskey, so it's going to be a good day. Thank you.
Thanks, Zach. We're hearing Alaskans disclose true stories about their lives, no matter how embarrassing. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. In case you hear a story you'd like to share with a friend, all the past Arctic Entries stories are available for listening on our website at arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud. You can listen to this show in its entirety at alaskapublic.org.
Okay, take a breath, and on a serious note, our next storyteller, lifelong Alaskan, Sarah Frazee, is going to take us to one of Alaska's favorite vacation destinations, Hawaii.
My sister and I were making breakfast in our gorgeous Airbnb in Kauai. We had just put on a pan of hash browns, we had some chocolate croissants baking in the oven. And you know, these croissants had actually been quite the ordeal. My other sister had brought them with her from Oregon, and they had started to rise in her suitcase. So when this screeching alarm went off, I thought, oh my gosh, these damn croissants. Like, pick a different timer. The croissants are not gonna burn. It was this shrill screeching sound. And then my sister went over to shut off the alarm, and then I heard her say, ballistic missile inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. And it took me a minute to make the jump from burning croissants to ballistic missile. And I went and I looked at her phone and I saw it there in all caps. And in the amount of time that that took, the rest of my family had come in from the Lanai. And my dad immediately went into his military training and he said, grab closed-toed shoes, grab blankets, and I grabbed my toddler from my mom and had the wherewithal to turn off the oven, and I remember seeing my mom grab the pallet of water bottles that we'd picked up from Costco the day before, and my sister Emily, who's 6 months pregnant, grabbed a bag of tortilla chips and Hawaiian sweetbread. Her husband started grabbing blankets, and I grabbed diapers and wipes, which in retrospect is not something you probably need for a nuclear holocaust. But then we headed out to the detached garage. And when I got out there, Emily and Brandon were trying to move this big stand-up paddleboard against the one window in the garage. And it's the kind of window in the tropics where it has the slats where you're thinking like, oh, it's so beautiful outside, why would I ever want this window to close? And my little sister, Laura, is trying to clear out boxes from this built-in table. Now, at this point, my parents have joined us in the garage, and my dad immediately puts his hands in the air like this. This is how he talks. And I think my dad thinks maybe no one's going to interrupt him if he talks this way. And he said, you are going to see a light. It is going to be the biggest light you have ever seen. Do not look at the light. You are going to put your head down, and you are going to go in the direction of the light. And now at this point, Emily, Brandon, and Laura have taken shelter underneath the table in the garage, and they are covering themselves with a giant windsurfing kite and a blanket.
and they're all huddled and kneeling underneath this table. And at this point, my mom comes over to me and she says, "Sarah, where are you and Tommy gonna go?" And I'm holding my toddler and I realize I've just been pacing back and forth and I've moved the same box three times. And I didn't know where we were gonna go. So my mom takes two rugs out of the dryer and I recognize one of them as the rug that Tommy had smeared almond butter all over the day before. And she made us a little nest in the corner. Now my dad's saying, "There's going to be a wall of heat. It's going to travel at speeds greater than 100 miles per hour. It's going to be the hottest thing you have ever felt." And at this point I hear Brandon say, "Well, maybe we don't want to be covering ourselves with this wind kite. This synthetic material is going to burn and melt into our skin." And I think it was at that point that I realized we were in our last moments. My little sister Laura said, "I love you guys." And we started saying our goodbyes. And at this point, I didn't feel confident in my abilities to not look at the light, but figure out where I was supposed to position ourselves. And so I took Tommy underneath the rug, and I'm hovering over him, and I'm shielding him with my body, and we're under this rug, and I'm looking down into his beautiful brown eyes. He has my husband's eyes. And I was thinking about my husband, who was flying to Kauai at that time because he had to take a later flight than us. And I thought about how I wasn't going to get to say goodbye to him. And I thought about how he's probably worried because I'm guessing that he heard about it on onboard Wi-Fi. And then I remember you don't get Wi-Fi over the water. But I keep coming back to the fact that I'm not going to get to see my son grow up because I know in my head I am going to do whatever it takes to make sure that Tommy is safe. I am gonna take the fall for him, and I need Tony to get here because I didn't really know what was gonna happen, but in my head, all I had was disaster movies, and so I'm thinking he's gonna have to be like Dwayne The Rock Johnson and get a speedboat and somehow save our son in this nuclear holocaust. But then I start thinking about all of the moms around the world who shield their children regularly, and I remembered this story that I read about in middle school where this one mom in World War II suffocated her child trying to keep him safe and calm. And now I hear my dad say, "A ballistic missile can arrive from North Korea in 37 minutes. And we're at about 30 minutes. So we're in our last few minutes, and Tommy's making his "no mama" face that he does. And it's hot under there, and he's flushed, and I decide to come out from underneath the rug, and he'd just learned to walk, so of course I'm having to, like, corral him to me. And I think, okay, what's going to work in this case? And I start singing songs from our music class back here in Anchorage, and I'm cursing the fact that I can't remember his favorite one about the horse, but I start singing, "I'm a little froggy and my mama loves me. I'm a little froggy and my daddy loves me." And then I hear Brandon say, "Guys, it's a false alarm." And then 37 minutes comes and there hasn't been a ballistic missile. And then at 38 minutes, we hear that same screeching alarm sound that verifies that it was a false alarm. And within an hour, we're at the farmer's market and people are drinking out of coconuts and eating exotic fruits and listening to ukulele music and acting like nothing ever happened. But we just had this shared trauma together. And it's been 2 months and there are days that I still don't trust the sky yet. And there are days that I flinch when my phone goes off, and I'm changed. I know now that we're not in control, and that your life can change with a text message.
That was Sarah Fragy, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage. I'm Cody Liska.
And I'm Rosie Robards. We're hearing stories of mad love, losing control, and drinking the Kool-Aid. Our theme is Under the Influence. In the spirit of this theme, our next storyteller has enjoyed revealing a story about a time when he was much younger and perhaps didn't have the best judgment.
So this all happened not long after I turned 19.
I'd been in the Navy for about a year, and things are going really good. I'm having a good time. I got stationed in Italy, and I'd already seen some new countries, and I'm making these great new friends. And these friends asked me if I want to go take a trip with them, like a guy's trip over Thanksgiving through Europe. And of course I do, and we get together to plan it out, and we decide we want to go to Switzerland to go skiing, and we want to go to Munich to go drinking, and we want to go to Amsterdam, because why wouldn't we want to go to Amsterdam? So we get together to make all the plans, get the reservations, and we decide Amsterdam has to come first because we need that time in between so maybe we can pass our drug tests when we get home. All this planning went down the week before September 11th. And on that day, we would recall everybody back to the ship. This all happened in the afternoon, evening in Italy. Recalled everybody back to the ship. Everything that was taken apart was put back together. We loaded up a bunch of food and deployed that night. With no timetable and no real clear mission, we were cut off from communication. We had no phones, no email. News to the ship was pretty scarce. This was a stressful time. And I'm starting to wonder if this whole join the Navy idea last year was a big mistake. I joined at a time of peace for a steady paycheck and a one-way ticket at a North Pole. And now we're out here and the days are turning into weeks and I'm getting really concerned that we're not going to get to go to Amsterdam. But we did get back to town in early November, but there was a new rule. We were put on what was called a four-hour tether. Even on leave, we couldn't be more than 4 hours away from the ship. That would include Amsterdam. But we all know that the officers that are giving these orders are probably going to go back to the States for Christmas anyways. So f*** those guys. The night we got into Amsterdam, we hit the ground running. We went out to dinner, we had some drinks, we found this place that sold psychedelic mushrooms, we ate a bunch, laughed all night, got to bed pretty late. The next day was gonna be our Amsterdam day, the day we were gonna walk into a coffee shop, buy some marijuana, and smoke it. And we found the perfect place. It was quiet and cozy. It was just the seven of us in there and the guy behind the counter. And my friend Uncle Rob goes up to the man behind the counter and asks which kind of marijuana he recommends. And he says, we got this one called Reclining Buddha. It's the best in Amsterdam right now. And he shows us all of the pre-rolled joints he has of it. And Uncle Rob asks, how many of those joints is going to take to get all seven of us high? And the man says, one. These are big, fat joints. Uncle Rob says, we'll take seven. So we go into the other room, try to smoke all seven of these joints, unsuccessfully. I don't think anybody could, because there was a point where I couldn't really move. But so I didn't know that a person could possibly be this high. Once we were able to talk and walk again, we went out looking for some food. And we're walking down this pretty fancy area of Amsterdam, and I'm kind of glancing out of my eyes as we walk by restaurants, and I want to see what these people are eating. I want to see how good it looks. When I notice something bizarre. And I say, hey guys, stop and check this out. They say, no, Daniel, we can't eat here. They're not going to let us in, and we couldn't afford it if they did. And I said, no, and my face is right in the window now. I said, these people aren't real. I said, what are you talking about, Corey? Of course they're real. They can hear you, and you sound like a lunatic. So I bring them over, and they're like, guys, check it out. And all seven of our heads are in the window, and I'm pointing. Look, they're all like cardboard cutouts with, you know, like hinges for arms, and there's probably like strings and pulleys somewhere, and the waiter's moving around on like a toy train set. That's what's happening in here. And I'm starting to convince some of these guys to see it my way. We still argue whether or not those people were real. The day would go on like this because we still had all the rest of those joints. We'd get lost on a sidewalk for 20 minutes because we couldn't remember how maps worked. It was a really good day. The third day was going to be like our cultural experience day, because that's what we thought adults should be doing. As we're getting ready in the morning, there's talk about museums or art galleries, and my friend Steve, who's like the leader of the group, he's like the cultured, mature one, recommends that we go to the Anne Frank House. And because he's Steve,
I agree with him. He's the 23-year-old sage wise man of the group. And he gets enough votes and we do go to the Anne Frank house. Now, I didn't get the best high school education, not because we have bad teachers in North Pole, but because I just never really paid attention. I was the guy that was always looking out the window, look at the clock, head on the table, look at the clock again. It must have been when this was going on that we learned about Anne Frank, because I had no idea who she was. I had no idea where we were going. But I promise if I did know, I wouldn't have ate the rest of those mushrooms with Uncle Rob on the way. Now we get to the Anne Frank house and go inside. And the first thing that I notice is that it's really sad. I'm learning about this girl and her family and her friends. And it's just stunned silence through the whole place. People wondering, like, how could this happen? How could people be so cruel? And you think about the millions of other people that had to experience the same nightmare. It was a truly moving experience. And we're moving through this museum, and the next thing I notice is those mushrooms are starting to kick in. This isn't good. I'm afraid. I'm not afraid because I'm gonna have like a bad trip because I'm literally inside of a house of sadness. I'm afraid because every time I've taken this drug in the past, I've had horrible laughing attacks. And I don't know if it was like the secret rooms and trick doors or the mushrooms, but I couldn't find my own way out of there. So horrified, I physically take my hand, put it over my mouth so nothing stupid can get out. And I just follow Steve out. I'm just thinking, follow Steve, maintain. Don't be an a**hole. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your hand over your mouth. It's taking forever. We're going from room to room. It might have just seemed like that, but I was following Steve to try to get out of there. He was my leader on the way out, and he's reading everything. Good for him. But bad for me. And finally, we do get to the room where I see the exit. And I managed to get out of there without making a total asshole out of myself. And even though I didn't experience Anne Frank House in a conventional way, I did learn something. And as I stepped out into that crisp, cool day, it was sunny, I had a new appreciation for my life and the freedoms that I had to do all the things I want to do. I was talking to my friend Danny, who was there on this trip a lot in the past 2 weeks, and he said, why didn't you talk about all the stuff we did in Switzerland or all the stuff we did in Germany? I said, there just isn't enough time. But we would have plenty of time together because once we did get back to the ship, we all did pass the drug tests that we got almost immediately when we stepped back on board. Thanks.
You're hearing the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
As we briefly talked about earlier, the stories on this show come from a special edition of Arctic Entries, which took place at the Beartooth Theater Pub. At these shows, we sometimes invite past storytellers back to the stage. Next, we'll hear from Darl Schaff.
So for over 50 years, my father smoked a pipe. And when he got lung cancer, my entire family was shocked. He told me one time that he quit smoking cigarettes because when they went to 25 cents a pack, it was just too expensive. Couldn't handle that anymore. So I missed a lot of his life because when I was 16 years old, I ran away from home and I didn't come back for 20 years. So when I came back, my brother and my sisters had all grown up. They had families, they had moved away, they had their own life. I was never really close to my father, but he was curious and I liked that about him. He told me one time that when he died, he wanted to be cremated, and he wanted to have his ashes thrown into a river where he loved to go fishing. Well, he was the first person in our sort of Southern Baptist family who had even contemplated cremation, and my family was shocked. He died not long after that. I got the call from my mom, and I said to her, listen, I'm really tied up with something. It's going to take a couple of days for me to get free, but I'll fly home. I'll be there to distribute the ashes. I'll join you for that. So let me tell you about my family. So my older sister was born with all the knowledge in the world. She was an expert on absolutely everything, no matter whether you believed it or not. She knew the answer to everything. My brother, who was also older, was the school bully. He was married 3 times. He drank incessantly, and he was my father's absolute favorite son. My middle sister, by this point in her life, had become a sort of depressed recluse and basically hated everyone that she ever met, no matter who. And my baby sister was, at least in theory, the daughter of my oldest sister, born out of wedlock, that my mother took to raise. So have you got that all now? Okay. So let me make one more thing clear to you, and that is that these people have, by this point in their life, all learned to hate each other, and none of them have been together in a room for years. And then I arrive. So it didn't really surprise me that nobody had bothered to pick up the ashes of my father for several days. So I went to the funeral home and I got the ashes, and they gave them to me in a little cardboard box. Now, I'm a cremation virgin, so I just assume whatever they give me is what is supposed to be there. So I take it home, I put it in the car, I take it home. So we plan the next morning, we are all going to drive to the river. We're going to do this thing. Now, I'm a planner. That's what I do for a living. I plan things. So I had planned this out totally. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I had bought 6 matching little boxes, and my thought was that I was going to put my father's ashes in each of those 6 boxes, and each of us would then have a moment where we could independently dump our dad into the river. Because I knew if I tried to make this a group activity, there would be another death that we'd have to do, Will. The other thing I did was I bought pipe tobacco because he had smoked for 50 years. So I thought, well, I'll put the pipe tobacco after we dump his ashes. I'll put the pipe tobacco in the boxes. Everybody will then, later on, you can like open the box and sort of smell my father and it'll be a reminder, you know. I thought this was good. Now, come on. So the morning comes. It's time to go do this thing. Now, remember, all these people hate each other. So there's 6 of us that have to squeeze into a rental car, first of all. This is awful. So I'm a planner, so I'm trying to make everything work. So I look in the trunk of the car, and I've got the cardboard box with my father's ashes. I've got the 6 little boxes. I've got the pipe tobacco. I'm all set. And then I think, I'm going to take inventory. What else do I need? Do I need anything else? I need something to be able to get the ashes out of the cardboard box and put it into the little boxes. So I look around my mother's garage, and what do I see? I see a giant Tide detergent box. And in those days, we all knew that if you bought the really big box, it came with a scoop. So I found the scoop, and I throw it in the back of the car, and I'm all set. So we drive for an hour and a half. Now, this is an hour and a half in 100-degree weather. Fortunately, we had air conditioning. But we're just squeezed into this car. Everyone's having a terrible time. My sister, who knows everything, is saying, I don't understand why he had to be cremated. I just don't understand why he was cremated. And my sister, who is the complete depressed one, says, he's dead. So my brother's in the front seat. He's like, shut up. So this goes on for a whole hour and a half until we get to the river. So I finally tell everybody, go down to the river, find a spot where you want to do this thing. I'll get everything prepared. Now, remember, I'm a cremation virgin, so I go back, I open the trunk, and I set out the 6 boxes. I have all the pipe tobacco ready to go, and I open up the cardboard box. And I'm not sure what I thought was in the cardboard box, but what was in the cardboard box was this heavy plastic hermetically sealed capsule that's designed to never open under any condition whatsoever. So that threw me for a minute. And then I think, well, maybe it'll just, you know, I'm twisting and I'm turning and nothing's working. So I think, well, maybe if I try bumping it on the back, you know, where the trunk is. So I hit it a couple of times, and I'm being careful because I don't, you know. The third time, now it's 100 degrees out. They're still screaming down at the river. Everybody's screaming. So nothing. So I think, all right, I'm smarter than this. I can make this work. Let's see. I start looking through the car. I'm in a rental car in the middle of the woods, you know, an hour and a half from my house. I have nothing, but I find a tire iron. Ha-ha! So I take out the tire iron, and I put my father's ash prison, whatever you want to call it. and I start out, I hit it kind of like, boom, boom, boom. Nope, nothing. Nothing happens. Not a scratch, nothing. This thing is never going to come open. I know that as a fact. So my brother comes walking back and he says to me, what's going on? It's been like 20 minutes. They're all still down at the river yelling at each other. And I said, oh, nothing. It's all good. Listen, do you have a knife on you? And he said, yeah, I always carry a knife. And I go, okay, my brother's a big guy. I thought he'd have a big knife. He pulls out this little tiny, tiny little knife that opens up, and I'm like, okay, great. Go. Goes back to the river. I think I gotta make this work. I gotta figure this out. So I brace this plastic thing in the trunk, and I take that knife and I start stabbing it. I'm like, no, 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 no. And after about 16 times of stabbing, I get the tiniest little hole to start. Just a tiny little hole. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm sweating like a pig. Finally, I go, okay, this has got to work. So I grab the tire iron and I force the tire iron into that little hole, and I'm pulling it, pushing it. Nothing. By this point, I am so frustrated, I can't tell you. And I think, it's so close. I know it's so close. So I pick it up and I look around and I think, I'm just going to do this. So I brace it. Here's the back of the trunk. And I go, last one, I go, doom, pow. It splits in half. Half of my father goes into the trunk and half of my father goes out on the lawn. So I grab my trusty Tide scoop and I start picking it up, and I'm scraping up all the stuff in it. And I'm trying to find enough of my father to put into six little boxes, you know. So I realize when I get to about the fourth box, I'm running out of father. So I think, well, I'll get some of the stuff in the grass. So I'm down, I'm like trying to pick up my father in the grass. And I realize as I'm throwing it into the boxes, it's got grass and rocks and bugs and all sorts of stuff in it. So I sort of even out five of them, and I dump all the grass and stuff into one more, and that'll be my box. I'll be good. That'll be good. So I take them down to the river and I hand them out to my family. And I witnessed the most amazing thing I think I've ever seen in my life. My sister, that is the expert on everything, laid the box down next to the river. She kneeled next to it, and she began to pray. My depressed, recluse sister flipped open the box, dumped it, and walked back to the car. My baby sister is walking up and down because she can't figure out what it is she's supposed to do, and my brother wades into the river. And he gets to waist high. He's got the box over his head. He looks like John the Baptist. And he opens the top, and as he pours my father's ashes into the river, he lets out this primal scream. Ah! And of course, I'm horrified. I'm watching this entire thing happening. So eventually, we all get back, and they all get back in the car, and we drive home. And different from driving down, when we drove home, it was very quiet. There was a little sobbing. Nobody said anything. I was biting my lip till it was bleeding, trying not to laugh because of what I had just witnessed. I never told my family this story, ever, because I thought they would be shocked. But the one piece of satisfaction I'll tell you that I got out of this entire story was that my father loved to go on road trips. And in my heart, I like to think that some part of him is still in the back of that rental car in Florida, driving around right now. Thank you.
Thanks for that story, Daroshoff. This has been a special Beartooth Theater Pub edition of the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. To hear these stories again, or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way. The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our site.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. And this show was edited at the Alaska Teen Media Institute by Kendall Stormo. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Cody Liska. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.